Hello and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Carol High, a member of the club's Asia Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Stuart Gaffney and John Lewis have been leaders in the marriage equality movement for over a decade. Together as a couple for 27 years, they were two of the plaintiffs in the historic 2008 lawsuit that held that California's ban on same-sex marriage violated the state constitution. On June 17, 2008, they married at San Francisco City Hall. Stuart and John are leaders in Marriage Equality USA, a national community-based organization, and API Equality, a coalition targeting outreach and education to the Asian American community. They have appeared extensively in local, national, and international media. The focus of their work has been to foster connection between the general public and the lives of LGBT people. They've spoken at numerous universities and other public forums. They just returned from Japan for the second time, where they have given talks about marriage equality at universities and symposiums, and met with Japanese LGBT leaders to discuss strategies for achieving full equality in the two countries. Please welcome Stuart Gaffney and John Lewis.
Thank you very much, the Commonwealth Club. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight. So the issue of marriage equality and LGBT equality is very much in the public eye right now. And actually this afternoon or this morning in Chicago, Illinois, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court of Appeals heard two cases, one regarding marriage equality in Wisconsin, and one involving equality in Indiana. And it was really an extraordinary hearing, I must say, because all three judges appointed by Presidents Reagan, Clinton, and Obama, so different presidents, they were relentless to the opponents of equality. They would not stop. And even when the time had ended, and one of the attorneys for, I believe it was the state of Wisconsin, said, my yellow light's on, I think I gotta go now. They said, oh no. And they just kept going. And something that was extraordinary, which really connects to what I think the theme is tonight as well, is that I was really struck beneath it all that these three judges, coming from different places, they recognized the inherent humanity and dignity of LGBT people. And they also were deeply, deeply concerned about how their exclusion from the freedom to marry hurt children in LGBT families. And so they really, really got it. And what they got, in my view, at base, underneath all the legal arguments, was our common humanity. And if there's one thing, as we talk tonight, that I think has undergirded the success of our movement for really over 10 years in the marriage equality movement, but really the movement for LGBT equality, is this theme of our common humanity, as demonstrated by real stories of real people, some of which are magnified on television and in court cases, and many of which have occurred over dinner tables, between a son and a dad, or a son and a mom, or daughter and a sister and a sibling, all sorts of people. And this has brought our humanity, which we're going to talk about. And so we're going to try to, since we're talking about common humanity and stories, we're going to integrate our own personal story into sort of some of the story of political, legal, and social change over the last 10 years, and then certainly talk about where we are now and what might be headed, what might be coming next. And the other special treat of our presentation is that you can talk about being, quote, gay married, but we're going to do this presentation together. So you can decide for yourself how our being gay married is actually working.
Marriage in action, truly. So we want to start not at the very beginning, but close. Here we are as young people, this is right around the age where I first realized that I was gay. I never thought I was straight, but this is the age where I thought, oh, I actually want to grow up and meet my Prince Charming. I like to think as I look at these photographs that I'm actually dreaming of John here. It is possible that I'm smiling because it's actually Christmas morning, and we just opened all our photos. There's my sister there and my brother's ear. But in fact, I was also thinking, what does the future hold for me? How can I make this way in the world and live my happily ever after?
And I'm here about 10 years old, and I was born in 58, so it's 1968 probably there. And I remember that's sort of when I first thought, I'm a little bit different from a lot of those other boys, because so many of them they're all obsessed. They're starting to get obsessed with girls, and I just don't get it. I don't know what they're talking about. And of course, years later, reflecting back, I realized that I, in fact, was quite interested in the other boys in the class, not the other girls.
So unbeknownst to us, we were, in fact, growing up in a world where
PowerPoint needs to make sure it can change.
Well, although the slide is not advancing, where people were, in fact, discussing the subject of marriage equality. And in fact, in 1969, two young men named Baker and McConnell founded one of the first student organizations at a university in Minnesota called FREE, dedicated to LGBT equality. And they also, here they are, wanted to get married. So here they are asking for a marriage license. This is in 1970. Unfortunately, they were turned down and they had a novel idea. Let's file a lawsuit.
And one of the themes that we have identified through the movement too in our question in the title, is it revolution or evolution? Incremental change or immediate change? Is it radical or is it very traditional? And in a sense, Baker and McConnell represent both. The organization FREE stood for Fight Repression of Erotic Expression. So it was very much of the 70s. And in fact, I believe it was, they had founded the second student LGBT organization in the history of the United States. But something that's interesting, and we can talk about it more in question and answer, their lawsuit was also inspirational. They were asking for full equality back in 1971, 72. But something happened. The U.S. Supreme Court dismissed their case. And actually, the case called Baker versus Nelson is something that was discussed in today's Seventh Circuit hearing as whether the dismissal of that case, and I won't get into all the technicalities, whether that controls what the circuit courts need to do right now. It won't control the U.S. Supreme Court, but so the decision that these two college students made to bring this lawsuit is actually having still an effect now over 40 years later. So it's an interesting example in progressive or any sort of legal and political social change, making smart decisions. And it's yet to be known whether it was the smart decision to do.
Well, 27 years ago, I made a smart decision. It took me a little while, but I met this man at a small house party right here in San Francisco. And I remember distinctly 1 week after we met that a friend of mine asked me if I'd met anybody new, and I said I had met my future husband. I used those words. And I know one thing it meant to me at the time, because sometimes people ask, was it love at first sight? But to me, it was, we were family at first sight. We spoke the same language. It was like we'd already known each other forever.
Now, why is that? There we go.
So Some other things were happening the first year, the year that we met. There was a March on Washington for LGBT equality. And we were part of an activist group then called Queer and Present Danger.
And what the United States Supreme Court had decided in 1987 was that laws across this country that allowed states to put same-sex couples, put LGBT people in jail for physical expression of affection and love for each other were fine by the United States Constitution. It was an infamous case called Bowers versus Hardwick. And this had been decided in 1987. And Stuart was there at the March on Washington, and these are some of our friends who are part of this group called Queer and Present Danger, because there was extreme anger at the idea that we could be put in jail for being gay, essentially, that the U.S. Supreme Court had stated.
So our movement is complex and encompasses many things. So at the March on Washington, there was this historic protest that shut down the Supreme Court for the one time in history in protest over one of its decisions. There was also the dramatic and emotional unfurling of the Names Project memorial quilt on the Mall that is just, I actually feel emotional just saying that to you. It was an incredible time in our community and our country's history. But also, and you see in the other picture here, was an event called The Wedding. And actually still to date, it is considered one of the largest group wedding events ever. Over 2,000 LGBT couples pledged their love and devotion to each other before an audience estimated over 7,000. And as our movement is still today, it was one part protest. This event was held in front of the IRS building to say no taxation with discrimination. But it was also, of course, mainly about the love and commitment that we share. And Reverend Troy Perry, the founder of the MCC Church, was there, and he said, out of the closets and into the chapels. So over time, although we couldn't literally say I do, we built a life together. And here are just a few snippets. We backpacked around the world together. Here we are in Cambodia. We shared many other adventures. Here we are hiking in the Sierra. And we became part of each other's lives and each other's families. So here we are. We have two lovely nieces, and we always spent the holidays together. And this is what a family, this is what love is all about.
And then came April 14th. About 7:30 in the evening, we were early that year, and we had all the papers strewn across the dining room table, calculating the taxes. And there was a moment, looking at that tax form and thinking about it, that we got to this box. After you put in your name and ID information, it says filing status, and it says either single or married. And I don't know why exactly, but at that moment, it just struck us like a dagger to the heart. Here with our own hand, we had to take a pen and sign under penalty of perjury that we're telling the truth, and then lie and deny who we were as people, deny our basic human dignity that we were gay people, and deny our family. Together then for 16 years, we had to lie and say that we were single. And then take out the calculator, do the math, and write a check, in our case, for a lot more money to that same government that would not give us equal rights and equal dignity under the law. So we decided that we should get involved. It took a few months to really get involved, but we decided that we should go, or the plan was that I would go to a rally that was going to be held on the steps of San Francisco City Hall on February 12th, 2004. And since this is a local crowd, I think most of you know what was about to happen on February 12th, 2004. When I went to the rally, I had no idea what was going to happen. I was coming to support the cause, and we always say, always show up for the rally. You never know what's going to happen, because I showed up, and it was the very first hour that San Francisco was issuing the marriage licenses. And I was just, I became just ecstatic, and I didn't know just what to do, because I didn't own a cell phone, and I had a problem. I had no husband with me. He was downtown, he had a lunch meeting, and eventually I was able to get a cell phone, and someone would dial him, and I got him on the line.
It was the most urgent wedding proposal ever. It went something like, "Get here now!" But there was no question. We'd never said I do. But we had lived as married, and there was no question that we would march through those doors, and this would be our wedding day.
And we will not bore you with all the stories of February 2004, one I think maybe people are familiar with, and one of the things that was just delightful about the actual day is that after you fill out your paperwork and all that sort of stuff, in the most deadpan voice, the clerk gives you, here is your pregnancy and family planning information. And there's a copy of the book we actually got. So, of course, this caused waves of laughter across the clerk's office, but he was also profound because we were being treated just like everybody else in the most bureaucratic, ordinary way. We got the family planning and pregnancy information just like everybody else. And then came the moment in this beautiful old Beaux-Arts building of City Hall. We heard these words ring out, and now, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the state of California, I pronounce you legally married, spouses for life. And I had no idea what was coming. I just felt these chills go up and down my body. I didn't see it coming. And I felt these places where, even though I'd been out as a gay person for decades, this little bit of shame or this or that, this idea inside that as a gay person, I was always going to be just a little less than, just a little second best, maybe a domestic partnership, but never the full thing. And I realized this is the first time in my life as an LGBT person that I feel like an equal human being in the eyes of my government, and that our love, our relationship, our family is being treated with the same respect that everybody else has. And that moment was transformative. It really was transformative because it showed us this marriage equality movement is not just about marriage. It really is about our dignity as human beings. And also, once we had tasted that, this was the very first day we were involved. We had tasted the end. We had felt the end. We'd felt the goal. It just motivated us to say, we've got to do everything to make this a lasting, permanent reality. Not just the freedom to marry, but the dignity that came with that moment for anybody who wants it, for all LGBT people, and indeed for all people as a human right, that basic dignity.
When we told our family, our niece Lin Wan said, "Why wasn't I invited?" Not realizing that it wasn't possible for us to get married the day before. But she immediately rushed out and got us wedding gifts because she knew what you do when you hear about a happy couple. You congratulate them, you give them gifts, you celebrate love and marriage.
And so, as many folks know, there were thousands of people that came to City Hall and got married. And then those marriages suddenly were stopped. And the California Supreme Court ultimately ruled that the mayor of San Francisco and the county of San Francisco couldn't end discrimination against LGBT folks in marriage on its own. They said you have to go to the court first, and there has to be a lawsuit. So we and other couples and the city of San Francisco itself, we together brought a lawsuit to challenge California's ban on marriage for same-sex couples. And we, as looking at opposites, sort of different poles of the movement and how common humanity sort of unites the movement going forward, we had had that taste of equality. We had gotten married and had it taken away. And Jeannie and Polly, another couple with us, they had the exact opposite opinion, experience. Jeannie, I think, was 60 at the time, and she was right in line to get married just when the order halting the 2,000 marriages happened. and she found herself running down City Hall trying to get married before they stopped it. And she just looked at herself and said, I'm a 60-year-old, you know, tax-paying, law-abiding American citizen. Why do I have to run down the hall of City Hall to try just to be able to marry? So it brought both ideas, the vision and the pain of exclusion, all together in one lawsuit.
So it takes lawsuits time, as we all know, to work their way through the court system. During that time, we took inspiration from another couple. This is my mom and dad. This is an important parallel to our own case. My mom is Chinese American. My dad, English and Irish American. They were only able to legally marry in California, where they met, because the California Supreme Court had done the right thing for interracial couples and made it possible. My dad likes to trace our family back to the Mayflower. And my mom's family's actually been here for a long time, too. They moved to Hawaii in the late 1800s. And when my mom went to UC Berkeley, this was the map of red and blue states, the blue states being the ones where it would have been legal for my mom and dad to get married. Not so many. And it's, you see, at that time, it would have been illegal for my parents and our family to exist as a legal unit. Luckily, that all changed, but my mom was a member of the Chinese Students Club and remembers when it was commonplace, if somebody fell in love with someone of another race, that you would leave California to get married, because that's what you had to do. Much as same-sex couples today have to choose what jurisdiction they're going to get married in, if they can, and what their rights are going to be if they move around the country.
And the California Supreme Court was the first court to strike down one of those marriage bans. And as you see here in the quote, they said the essence of that freedom to marry is the freedom to marry the person that you choose. And the words indeed were prophetic because 60 years later, they applied that same principle to sexual orientation for race in 1948, but then to sexual orientation in 2008.
So here are my parents setting out on their honeymoon. And here's the map of the country when they got married. You can see there are a few more blue states. Take a note of where they are. We're going to revisit this map later. And it wasn't until 1967, of course, that the entire country turned blue and that our family was finally legal all across the country. This is the couple that filed that lawsuit, Loving versus Virginia, best case name ever. And they actually did jail time because they had an illegal marriage. Mildred Loving later issued a wonderful statement embracing the meaning of that decision as not just for interracial couples, but for all loving couples, including LGBT couples. So guess what? 4 years later, good news. We are on the steps of the California Supreme Court. They always rule at 10 a.m. We were celebrating, and then at 10:01 a.m., my cell phone rang. Hi, Mom. Yes, it was my mother. And I said, oh, you must have heard the breaking news. We won. And she said, when's the wedding? And I said, Mom, I don't know. The ink is barely dry in the decision. We haven't read it yet. We don't know when it takes effect. We're celebrating with the other plaintiffs and legal counsel. And she said, that's nice. When's the wedding? And that's when I realized that my mom had now waited over 20 years to be able to plan a wedding with us. So plan a wedding we did.
And at this point in the presentation, we have come to realize the true meaning of marriage equality is that we get to inflict all of our wedding pictures on you. No, we will not do that. But here goes.
I will just say one thing here. So you saw the pictures of my mom and dad as newlyweds. Here they are, just a little bit older, and oh, maybe there's a little bit more of my dad. But so happy to see the next generation in our family finally achieving legal marriage equality.
And at age 90 today, they both are strong advocates for LGBT equality and marriage equality. And here we go with the pictures. And this, actually, is the judge who maybe some of you know, the Honorable Felton Henderson of the United States District Court. I clerked for him, and he's my mentor. And it was really wonderful that he performed the wedding for us. And wedding banquets, baklava for more pictures. And one thing I do want to say then that continues to be very important about the case out of California Though folks know that Prop 8 then caused some problems. But the California marriage case was actually discussed in the Seventh Circuit hearing just this afternoon. But there are a couple things that are really profound about it. And one is that it recognized a fundamental right under our state constitution to marry. And what it did was it removed gender as a factor in marriage. The state was no longer asking on the marriage application what your gender is. And on this theme, is marriage equality very traditional or is it radical? In one act, in a sense, it's both. Gender was no longer part of marriage in California. It didn't have to be. And yet LGBT people were joining one of the most traditional institutions in our society. But to me, what was really profound about it was the state of California, the Supreme Court of California said that every Californian, in essence, this was the result of the decision, has a fundamental right to marry the person that you love, not based on any external factor about who you are, your race, your gender, your religion, your sexual orientation, your gender identity, your disability status, your height, none of this stuff. Every human being has now a fundamental right to marry the person they love because they are a human being. And I thought that was really profound. And this is the result now that Prop 8 is gone, that we're back in that state, if you will, state of California. And this is just one example. This is Cynthia and Vicky. And Vicky Kolkowski is a Superior Court judge in Alameda County. She's a transgender woman. And she's marrying, she married her lesbian partner. They're both lesbians, obviously. Am I still on?
You're good.
Okay, great. So this is just an example of back when we had gender differentiation in marriage, there can be many legal complications for a transgender couple if, say, they married before one transitioned and their marriage could be, vulnerable and vice versa. Maybe they will become married if they were a same-sex couple and then they transitioned. All that complication, it didn't matter. It doesn't matter now. You are a human being. And I think that's just terrific. And the other thing that the case did, which is really important, it was the first case where it recognized that sexual orientation, gay, lesbian people, is a protected class under our state constitution. So classifications that discriminate on the basis of race or on gender, on some other factors, those are entitled under our Constitution to the highest protection. And through this decision, the California Supreme Court said, yes, sexual orientation is too. So this decision, though it was grounded in marriage, has a profound effect on the constitutional and legal rights of lesbian and gay people in all aspects of their lives, whether they're a homeless gay youth being harassed by a police department, whether they're in school and a state school says, this is the wing of the dorm for the gay folks because we want you to separate from the other folks. Whether you're a public employee, many, many different aspects. And so profoundly, the court recognized what we had felt in February 2004, that this is not just about a freedom to marry, it's also about equality as a lesbian or gay person.
So as we know, unfortunately, Proposition 8 put those very rights, and in fact, our very lives, up for a popularity contest. And in a very narrow election, LGBT folks were singled out for discrimination, and this resulted in a lawsuit. So the Prop 8 case went up before the U.S. Supreme Court and was decided just a year ago. Can you believe it's just a year ago that as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court action in this case, that marriage equality has been restored in California. And here are the plaintiffs in the Prop 8 case getting legally married. And also, this case set out a model for bipartisan support. Ted Olson and David Boies are really a model for reaching across the aisle, and that this is not a partisan issue. This is a human rights issue.
And of course, the case was very important legally, trial, and it very profoundly set forth the the reasons why marriage discrimination should be unconstitutional. But the case did something else that was very important, not just bringing marriage back to California, but that, did we run out of, yes, we did. But that it also continued public education and provided another example of how marriage equality is one aspect of the broader movement for LGBT equality.
And we have a personal example of this here today. So would you welcome up just for a moment Ryan Kendall, who was one of the key witnesses in the Prop 8 trial. And in fact, in a recent interview, Judge Vaughn Walker said that Ryan's testimony was the single most moving part of the Prop 8 trial. Ryan Kendall.
Hello, everyone. Thank you to Stuart and John for the invitation to briefly speak with you. There's so many amazing things that they've said, and I want to comment on all of them, but I can't. So briefly, I'm just going to talk about what I did in the Prop 8 case. Like Stuart and John, when I was about 6 years old, I realized that I liked other boys. I didn't realize that that made me different until I was 10 or 11 or 12, when I realized that there was a word for this called gay, and that everyone disliked gay people. And that was a very terrifying experience, particularly given that I grew up in a very conservative Christian family in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Well, unfortunately, when I was 14 years old, my parents found out I was gay, and they did not react well to this, as happens to too many kids. And they sent me to something called conversion therapy, which are psychological efforts that strive to change someone's sexual orientation from gay to straight. Obviously, this is a very abusive practice because it attacks what John references, our human dignity. It seeks to destroy you at your core, to say that there's something fundamentally wrong and bad about who you are and that it needs to be changed. But also empowers parents who very often don't really understand what their LGBT child is going through to discriminate against them because they go to a doctor. This doctor tells them that there's something wrong with their child. And they believe that. Many parents don't want their kids to be gay, so they seize on that, and they kind of vilify their own child, which is exactly what happened to me. My parents became increasingly abusive. My mother would tell me things like she had wished I'd been born with Down syndrome or been born mentally retarded instead of being gay. When I was 16 years old, I had to flee my family home, surrender myself to the Department of Human Services, and have my parents' custody revoked. And for the next 10 years, I struggled to stay alive. I was occasionally homeless, I was poor, I was suicidal, I was abusing drugs. Pretty much everything that happens to LGBT youth that are rejected by their families happened to me. Now, fortunately, I was able to survive this experience, and along the way, I met some interesting people who you may have heard from earlier. And because of them, I got wrapped up in this whole world of the legal process involving LGBT rights. And I was asked to testify in a marriage case called Perry v. Schwarzenegger. People may wonder, why did you testify about conversion therapy in a marriage case? They don't seem really related. But as John pointed out many times, what this is about is not about marriage, it's not about anti-discrimination laws, it's not about banning conversion therapy, although all of those things are incredibly important. It's about claiming the human dignity of LGBT people. Earlier, John referenced in remarriages in which the California Supreme Court decided that LGBT people were a suspect class, that they should be subject to the most protection that a court can give when it evaluates laws that impact these groups. And that's why I was called to testify, to prove, in essence, that our identity is our identity and that it's not something that can be changed or should be changed. And so I was offered as evidence that you can't pray away the gay. And this affects marriage, because if you are subject to heightened protection from a court and someone wants to take away a fundamental right like marriage, the court looks at it skeptically and says, you know, I don't think you can do that. That seems to be a suspect classification. You're discriminating against a group of people because of who they are. And so that's why I was offered in the Prop 8 case, because they needed to show that gay people are real and exist. And just briefly, I wanted to comment on this concept of evolution versus revolution in marriage, because I don't really think it's a good construct for us to think about these things. As John pointed out, what we're talking about is human dignity. And really, in a society, that's what the law is supposed to promote, human dignity. It's supposed to empower people. It's supposed to make sure that our families are safe, that we don't get kicked out of restaurants because of who we are, that we can't be denied housing or rental or jobs just because of who we are. The law is about empowering people. And so marriage isn't, to me, evolutionary or revolutionary. It's progress. This is what it looks like for there to be a better world, to protect people from discrimination, to make sure that loving couples can establish a family. And when you advocate for marriage, what you're really advocating for is human dignity. And every issue that affects any minority community is wrapped up in human dignity. And that's why marriage is such an important topic, because it's not just marriage. It's really, truly about everything else.
Thank you, Ryan. We're very lucky to have Ryan here. He is a hero to many of us. We're also proud to call him friend, and we're lucky to be at his recent graduation from Columbia University with highest honors, summa cum laude, and Phi Beta Kappa.
Which is where the oldest student group for LGBT.
Indeed. Indeed. So we want to talk a little bit right now about the current situation for marriage equality, where things are at now, what seems to be the most important thing going forward, and then so we'll have time for some discussion and questions, then we'll wrap up with one other point. But as you probably know, and we'll skip fast through some of this, the Defense of Marriage Act was overturned by the Supreme Court, which excluded same-sex couples who were legally married from over 1,000 rights and responsibilities under federal law. And it was a great victory, and we can talk more about an example of one of those rights. This is a binational couple that suffered dearly because of this exclusion, and we were at their wedding last week, and it was really wonderful to see their family safe again. And then this is what I wanted to point you to. when we're looking about going forward and what seems to be the most important thing to me as far as the legal arguments. The United States Supreme Court in the Windsor case, they could have issued a very clinical decision, sort of talking about these 1,000 rights. But they went much further than that. And these are the two quotes that really stand out for me, and that's why I put them up here. But the essence of it is that the court said, when you treat same-sex couples differently from everybody else, you undermine their dignity. As the quote says, it instructs everybody they come in contact with, even their own children, that there is something less than about them. And that DOMA humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples. That is 5 votes on the Supreme Court, 4 votes against, 5-4. That is the law of the United States. That is the law of the United States. And for decades and decades and decades, opponents of LGBT equality have tried to paint LGBT people as threats to children. And their latest incarnation of that was the Prop 8 campaign, if you might remember. You know, oh no, they're going to teach gay marriage in the schools, right? They always come back to it. Anita Bryant in the 70s. It goes all the way back to the 50s. And when I saw that, I said, wow. 5-4, Justice Kennedy and the United States Supreme Court, they got it on our side. They said the children that really need to be protected in all of this are the children of LGBT people. I think this is incredibly powerful victory for the community, and a legally important, because of course this rationale, this logic, though in the Defense of Marriage Act case, they didn't decide about whether individual states have to marry LGBT folks or not. But this logic, this rationale, it was cited today at the hearing. It's been cited in every hearing. And it's profound because it pulls the rug out on what our opponents like to use as their strongest argument. So looking forward, I think this is really important as a matter of law. If you're reading about the cases, looking at them as we go forward.
We thought it was just worth taking a moment to point out as we look at the evolution of the law, that this is the current map of the United States in terms of marriage equality. Note where those red states are. Those are the states with full marriage equality in the U.S. as of today. And note where the blue states are here. Those are the states that had marriage equality for interracial couples when my mom and dad got married. They're almost exactly the same.
And to me, it's really uncanny, you know, 60 years later, it's so similar, so similar. And then we're about to add a 39th victory. No one ever wants to predict how a court will turn out, but I think given today's hearing, we could predict a 39th. And so this is an incredible string, unprecedented string of victories. One of the district court judges noted that in his opinion. Never before in a space of a year after a Supreme Court decision, 38 wins. There was one loss in one state court, probably by a judge who just wanted to ruin the record. But it's showing overwhelming movement in the legal system. Again, 5 on our side, 4 against us at the Supreme Court. And what is tricky, and here are some of the cases that are possibly on their way to the Supreme Court. And they come from several different circuits. These are the federal circuit courts. Wisconsin, Indiana was heard today. Virginia has already ruled in our favor. Utah and Oklahoma from the 10th Circuit already ruled in our favor. We're waiting on the 6th Circuit. It's been argued, and we're waiting for a decision very soon. So if you see that on the news, that's coming up. That one from the oral argument seemed like possibly could go either way. And they might be relying on that case I told you, Baker versus Nelson, to sort of take a pass. And then September 8th, right here in San Francisco, come on over to the 9th Circuit, and you can actually hear the Idaho, and there's Nevada and Hawaii also being discussed. And then just a couple other things. I do want to say, just because we don't want to present, you know, there's incredible momentum, and it's really exciting. But I think we have to also say, not feel like this is in the bag. It's still very much important, I think, for everybody to continue talking, continue the advocacy, continue the support. Keep your voices up, even though it's in the courts. Because when the Supreme Court overturned interracial marriage bans nationwide, 2/3 of the states had already done it. And right now, we only have 19 states. And 3 of those were through court decisions by federal courts. So the Supreme Court generally likes to rule on issues when there's more progress having been made in states. But, as again, I pointed to that language, I pointed to the momentum, I pointed to the sense of common humanity. It seems very clear that we have a very, very strong case going forward, a very strong case going forward. So we are going to say one more thing before we get there, because this is what we want to just underscore again. And that is the power of coming out as part of this movement. And something that I consider simply magical about the LGBT movement is that we take the step of coming out as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender person, or as a friend, or as a family member. But we often take that step for our own personal well-being. I don't want to destroy myself inside anymore. I just can't take it if I don't become myself. Or a mom or a dad said, I'm tired of coughing over describing my daughter and her relationship. I want to be honest, truthful. Live life as we are as a family, or as we are as people. And to me, something magical is by so many people doing that, in one sense for their own personal well-being, we have created a huge political, social, legal movement. Because those acts, over and over and over again, have meant that we have educated millions of Americans, and really millions of people around the world, about who we are and basic human dignity and common humanity. And so, in closing, as we are approaching what a Supreme Court case that could be heard in 2015, this very next term, a victory is a victory that truly does belong to millions of people. Millions of people over generations, over decades, by doing those acts of coming out and speaking up. And as an activist, I would say we still have 9 months left or so for just the marriage issue. There's more to come. So the degree to which you are involved and continue to be involved, you'll feel that victory even more as we all take part in this movement together. So thank you so much.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to How Did Marriage Equality Go Mainstream? Evolution or Revolution? With Stuart Gaffney and John Lewis of Marriage Equality USA. So now it's time for questions. And we'll be passing the microphone. I'm sorry, I think we're down one microphone for the audience question period.
Any questions or comments?
Yes, great presentation. And I think you're right about remembering Harvey Milk's speech the day they defeated the Briggs Amendment. And it was all about coming out and claiming our human dignity. And and Frank Kameny before that claimed that. And so it's great. But I just personally, guys, what was your lowest point in your journey when you felt like we might not win this one, or whatever you felt? I'm just curious.
Well, I think there's nothing worse than having your own wedding taken away. So when those marriages in 2004 were declared null and void, and I realized that I had something in common with my mom and dad, who moved to Missouri when they still had their anti-miscegenation law in effect and were told that their marriage was null and void, that was a pretty low day.
And I think the other point to me, when I finally, we are incredibly optimistic people, and though the morning after Prop 8, when I was still holding on to hope after hope that Los Angeles County was going to come in a little differently, when I realized it actually had passed, oh, it felt awful. It felt truly awful. I think, I guess the other thing I want to say about that, though, there was a lot of anger and something, again, this idea that from polar opposites, you know, things happen. So there was, it was a horrible thing. It should not have happened. And what we thought about actually as we collected ourselves was based on what a meditation teacher had actually told me when I was doing an interview with her after a meditation retreat. And she told me, I don't want to hear about the worst thing that happened during your meditation. Tell me what the best thing was, because that's the way you're going to move forward. So I thought, what was the best thing that happened in this election? And I said, 5 million Californians voted in favor of LGBT rights, almost a majority. So we made a sign that said, thank you to the 5 million Californians who support the freedom to marry. And that was our sign. We loved participating in the rally and the demonstration, but we wanted to have a message that was forward-leading, because the forward-leading part of the Prop 8 campaign, of the whole debacle, was that so many people got it now. And it was not just about a few people who wanted to get married. It was about dignity and dignity for our family members and friends and everybody. And so to us, that was the forward thing. And we've seen this explosion of success. And that, I think, was that defining moment.
I actually have two questions, but if I can only have one, I'll tell you the second one. The second one is, what is next beyond the 9 months, beyond marriage? But the first one is actually more personal. I just spent a year living in the Middle East, working in the Middle East. And where this is like not even on the radar. And it was really, really sad for me to be there that year and observe, you know, the extremely under the radar gay people interacting with one another, not being at all acknowledged. I mean, there weren't, you know, beheadings or lashings or anything like that, but it was almost worse because there was nothing. In a year, the only thing I saw in the news once was that Bahrain, you know, that ridiculous, we're going to be testing people who are, you know, expats coming in, and if they're gay, they won't get in because we'll be able to test them, and that was so ridiculous. But other than that, there was not, never any mention anywhere, anytime, anywhere by anybody about gay anything. And so my question to you is, because I heard Japan mentioned earlier, what's your vision beyond, like, I know that, I guess we're not done here yet, so you got your work cut out for you here. But is there any, I feel sorry for my friends who are over there who wistfully look at Europe and the U.S. and think that that's heaven, and they are pretty much trapped. Is there any thought about the Middle East and other places like that and your work that might be become more global? Because you, by the way, you guys are fantastic speakers, and the passion and the professionalism, all three of you actually, is pretty inspiring.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you. And you know, yes, we just have returned from speaking on LGBT equality in Japan, and although we very much have work we still need to do here, we are very interested in the idea of taking it global, both into countries that are moving forward, but perhaps we can learn lessons from each other. And also, of course, there are countries that are moving backward right now. So we never want to forget our LGBT brothers and sisters all around the world. Something is very interesting for us in Japan, and it reminds me a little bit of what you said about the Middle East, although in perhaps less dramatic fashion, is that it's, in general, a more closeted culture. It's much harder for people to come out there currently. So people are living quieter, more private lives. And in some sense, the coming out model isn't perfect for the Japanese culture. It's a very personal act made public, or personal made political. In Japan, people see their thing that unites them much more as family and community and being together, not making, you know, live free or die statements. On the other hand, we saw in Japan that they have a tremendous advantage. It's a very nonviolent culture. People don't fear gay bashing. It's also a country that doesn't have a mobilized social conservative movement that is actually, like, people don't run for office in Japan on the platform of trying to take away our rights. So while they don't face that obstacle, they also don't have that to fight against. And I think we've talked about how Prop 8 was a mixed blessing, obviously a horrible thing in itself, but it also gave us a tremendous mobilization.
And can I just one other thing that comes to mind, I just have tremendous, you know, empathy and compassion for people in countries, LGBT people in countries like that who are facing, and many others who are facing repression, wherever it is. I just, in a sense, who am I to offer any insight on it? What came to mind, actually, was the memoir called Life and Death in Shanghai. And it was a story of a woman who suffered tremendously in the Cultural Revolution in China and was imprisoned and tortured and many, many, many things, just unspeakable horrors. And she survived. And in that case, she survived, I think, because she made a commitment to herself. She never would lie. She would never sacrifice her most deep integrity. And so she would not confess to what her captors were desperately trying to get her to confess. And because she did not confess, they didn't execute her, and she, you know, survived barely, but made it. And so for some reason, it came to my mind sort of, you know, if you can still somehow find some hope in a desperate situation like that, and you don't sacrifice somehow some part of who you are, and keep that hope there, something that is amazing about the human experience, whether it be someone like that, people who escaped the killing fields of Cambodia and somehow made it, people after the concentration camps after World War II, they somehow survived. If there's this core element of that humanity has, that we can survive unspeakable horrors, to keep that kernel of hope is what comes to mind. In some way, maybe to help people keep that hope regardless of how isolated they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I say in this crazy making, where do we still, you know, this profound question, what's the best thing that's happening? What do we have? Yeah, what do we have? And how can we move from what we've got? Where is the hope? Where is the kernel of strength? Where is the possibility? Because that's going to lead us further. And it's horrible, but that's the only hope to lead us further.
John and Stuart, as program organizer, I always make sure I get to ask a question. So just touching on your trip to Japan, were there any people that, young people maybe, that reached out to you, that moved you? Can you tell more about that? We'll go on for till about 10 after.
Well, we've been fortunate to go to Japan each of the last 2 years. And when we went 2 years ago, we spoke many times at a university. And a young woman reached out to us actually through an emissary and said that she needed to speak with us privately. She actually was scared to be seen publicly speaking to us or to ask us a question in front of other people. So we met her after hours in an empty classroom and just talked to her about her life. She knew she was bi. She was scared to tell another living soul. And she couldn't imagine a world where she could actually confide her crush that she harbored inside. And we're very lucky when we went back just a month ago to the same university that we met her again, and she is one of the five founding members of that university's LGBT students organization. She's come a long way. She actually marched in Tokyo Pride this year, but she did it with a mask on because she still is afraid to tell her family, and she didn't want to be captured in the media and be outed by the TV news.
And I think drawing back from your question, how we were sort of in Ryan's experience and many of our experiences, what as we talk to her, you know, you're sort of feeling the conversation, where do we need to really go? And what she really needed to hear, what the change was, that she was fantastic, just the way she was. You're a great person just the way you are. And that, in some ways, it's lucky to get to be born LGBT. It's really wonderful to have this incredible, you know, have male and female within your life, within yourself. And that she was wonderful. And that we needed her because she had a dream of doing LGBT manga. And I said, we need you. You know, so we understand it's tough, but come participate. So again, that affirmation for that person who, you know, it's the same thing, an affirmation, you are fine. You're wonderful as you are. So, and you had a question, yes?
My question is a little more detailed than yours about what's next. In your title, it talks about going mainstream. And you certainly gave us a great chronology of the legal progress that we've made, which is fabulous, and we're all thrilled with that. The question I have about mainstream, though, is that it's more than legal. It's cultural. And it's personal in terms of acceptance. And we live in a bubble here. So in the rest of the country, you obviously have been traveling. I'm wondering if you could comment more on the cultural side and less on the legal side about mainstream and what's next. And is it really mainstream in that sense?
Well, just a couple quick comments. Thank you for the question. We have a lot more slides we could have presented. One is that, so to complement the coming out as a cultural phenomenon is the effect that it has. Now, I agree that, you know, what you're saying about a bubble, not just the Bay Area, but California, the coasts. Nonetheless, this is when Harvey Milk told us to come out. And people come out, come out, come out, come out, come out. Over 60% support now for equal marriage rights. That would have been unthinkable back then, but it's now reality. Now, these numbers are not replicated in all parts of the country, of course, as you're wisely pointing out, but the trend is replicated, and especially among younger people. That gives us a lot of hope. I would say personally, being aware of the fact that in 1967, the Loving decision that we now take for granted, right? Of course, there shouldn't have been laws that said interracial couples couldn't marry. But actually, a Gallup opinion poll in 1967 said that over 90% of Americans thought that decision was wrong. And when people see the changing national polling on LGBT rights and marriage equality today, that actually is the historic parallel they point to, how in a generation that completely flipped, and now 90% of Americans would say it was unthinkable to ever outlaw marriage for interracial couples.
And I might just make a couple of comments too about it. And I agree with you. I don't like to call San Francisco a bubble exactly, but I agree with you that it's very different in different parts of the country. Very, very different. I think a couple barometers or indices of hope and success is that when Gavin Newsom did his thing, and we all did our thing in February 2004, it was, you know, Uber revolution, right? The mayor of St. Louis, Missouri, defied state law last month and married two couples in the state of Missouri to set up a lawsuit challenge in Missouri to the marriage ban. And so he did exactly what Gavin Newsom did. And Newsom, I think, didn't expect this to go on for a month. He thought it would be shut down and maybe Phyllis and Dell would have been married and that'd be about it. But there we have in Missouri, happening 10 years later, what was considered radical San Francisco values. And another example in Pennsylvania, the Republican governor of Pennsylvania, with possible national aspirations, in a very tight reelection campaign for governor of Pennsylvania, he had the choice of whether to appeal the federal court ruling declaring Pennsylvania's same-sex marriage ban unconstitutional. He chose not to appeal because he was worried about his reelection. So another example in Pennsylvania, which is, you know, elects some really conservative people sometimes, he was feeling there's one way this is going. Another thing I just want to really quickly do, because I'm sorry we don't have time, something that we have done a lot of work on is in the Asian American community, which actually has a lot of support for marriage. But one thing we wanted to do in our activism, and this is a picture of us in the Chinese New Year parade years ago, over 10 years ago, and we are dressed in the most traditional Chinese outfits. We're showing, our intention was to show deep respect for the Chinese culture, Chinese American culture, and to give the message that LGBT people, that we are part of the Chinese American community. This Chinese American community has this diversity. We should not be excluded from this. So I think this sort of general message that we are actually part of Alabama culture. We are not just in San Francisco. I come from Kansas City and Stuart's from Milwaukee originally. So we definitely have a feeling of saying we're part of, you know, family in Kansas City. We're not separate from it. Lastly, just as a pragmatic thing, because again, I'm such a hopeful person, I want to say, yes, we're going to change. It's hard. But something that was really striking, especially as advocates and that sort of thing and presenting our data, we have that great chart about coming out and marriage equality support going way up, right? Got our correlation. Well, so there's actually pretty extensive polling data about Japan and actually all the 15 most industrialized countries in the world. And something that was really striking to me was that if you ask Japanese, they ask in the poll, how many people actually know an LGBT person? 8% said for sure they knew an LGBT person. Another 15% said maybe. In Spain, I think it leads the world like over 60%. Here it's in the high 50s, I think. But wait a minute. There's another polling data that shows 70% support for gay marriage in Japan among people in their 20s and 30s. Now, wait a minute. They don't know gay and lesbian people personally, but the young people are totally on board, right, if you will. And it, I guess this is, a summing up sort of remark, again, which underscores how important the work we're doing here in America. So in our presentations in Japan, we were incredibly careful not to say, we're the Americans, we'll tell you what to do. And so we've been, you know, trying to be very, very sensitive. And it just reminds me, too, during our presentation, there are so many people who've made the marriage equality movement possible and the LGBT movement. We don't, by talking about our own story, mean to diminish anybody else's role. But that aside, but this was the point. So we had been so sensitive about, you know, making sure that we didn't tell everybody what to do. And the very last comment of our presentations in Japan by a very prominent lesbian leader there was, if you all win in America, it's going to have a huge effect on Japan. And it really struck us, and it was from her voice, not mine, but it struck us the importance of media, the importance of this interconnected world through the internet, and images of watching Modern Family in Tokyo and Osaka. And they watch Modern Family in Birmingham, Alabama, and Mississippi, too. And so this cultural shift that is intertwined with the legal and social and political advances, this is happening in conservative places as well. So, but I think it's a very important question you raised.
So I want to say, unfortunately, we are at the point in our program when we have time for one more question. And I want to see if there's anybody from this side of the room who would like to ask a question. I'll open it up.
Thank you. So sort of what's next specifically. So the Supreme Court of the United States has now three petitions to hear marriage cases before it. And then they meet the first Monday in October to start considering cases that they've already accepted, and they're trying to determine which ones to take for the upcoming term. And there'll probably be several of these before them in the next several weeks. And they might decide on which case to take as late as even the first week of January. Last time it worked, they decided first beginning of January, heard it in March, issued the decision in June. So it seems like there's no avoiding the issue. And so most observers think they probably will take one of these cases, and they issue their landmark decisions in June, at the end of June, like they did last time. But I guess I also want to say that there's so much more that's important going forward about the movement. We want to have a decision out of the court. You know, fingers crossed it's positive. We want it on the broadest grounds possible, because as I was explaining about having a broad California state decision, that really helps. So we want this to be forward moving for LGBT equality, not just marriage equality. And it's very important, the legislation in Congress for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act to add sexual orientation. Things to be watching in the news. One of the strategies of our opponents is to have these religious exception laws that are trying to undercut protections and gains made by women and by LGBT people. And then things related especially to transgender people, making sure that the military does not discriminate on transgender people. So there are many things going forward, and as we've said multiple times, we believe all these things move together, and they all can reinforce each other. So we very much don't want to give any impression, or don't even want to think, yeah, if we get a great marriage decision in 9 months, then great, we all, you know, we're done. So we get to continue even with a great decision. So thanks for the question.
Well, our thanks to Stuart Gaffney and John Lewis, Marriage Equality USA, for your comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California convening its 106th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.